Welcome back to the Journal Review. This is the March 2026 issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology, and we've got four pieces worth your attention this time. A large pharmacoepidemiology study on niacinamide and cardiovascular risk, a game-changer retrospective on head and neck melanoma in situ margins, a brief coding pattern report out of Arizona Medicare data, and a multi-center dermoscopy study on ultraviolet-induced fluorescence. Let's get into it. First up is an original retrospective cohort study titled Decreased Risk of Cardiovascular Disease in Dermatology Patients Taking Niacinamide, a TrinetX cohort study. You'll recognize the clinical backdrop immediately. We've been reaching for oral niacinamide, 500 mg twice daily, as chemoprophylaxis in patients with multiple non-melanoma skin cancers for years now, largely on the strength of the OnTrack trial. But a recent prospective discovery cohort and meta-analysis raised a real concern. Elevated levels of the niacin terminal metabolites, 2PY and 4PY, were associated with increased 3-year major adverse cardiac events. Since niacinamide sits downstream in the same metabolic pathway as niacin, that finding cast a shadow over a supplement most of us hand out reflexively. This paper set out to directly test whether niacinamide use is associated with cardiovascular harm, and whether that risk differs based on pre-existing atherosclerotic disease. Methodologically, this is a retrospective cohort built on the TrinetX Federated Network, which pools de-identified electronic health record data across more than 100 million patients from participating health systems. The authors identified patients with two or more non-melanoma skin cancer diagnoses, or bullous pemphigoid, who were then started on oral niacinamide above 500 milligrams. That dose threshold is important, since it excludes dialysis-related niacinamide formulations and other non-chemoprophylactic uses. These patients were propensity-matched 1-to-1 against niacinamide NAVE controls, matching on age, sex, race, ethnicity, and a long list of cardiovascular risk factors: hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, chronic kidney disease, heart failure, prior MI or stroke, smoking, and statin use, with a standardized mean difference target under 0.1, which is the accepted threshold for adequate balance in propensity-matched work. A retrospective database design here makes obvious sense. You're never going to randomize thousands of patients to niacinamide versus placebo and wait years for STEMIs to accrue. So leveraging a massive real-world claims and EHR network is really the only feasible way to power a rare outcome analysis like this. They also applied the Benjamini-Hochberg procedure with Story's Q-value method across the outcome panel, which is a sensible guardrail given they were testing 9 separate cardiovascular endpoints and wanted to control the false discovery rate rather than let multiplicity inflate their positive findings. After matching, each arm had just over 3,200 patients, so about 6,500 total. This was an older cohort, mean age right around 72, predominantly white, about 79% non-Hispanic and 59% male, with a heavy comorbidity burden. Roughly 6 in 10 had hypertension, about half had hyperlipidemia, a quarter had diabetes, and a quarter already had chronic ischemic heart disease. Here's the headline. Niacinamide use was associated with a significant reduction in ST elevation MI, 0.9% versus 1.6% in controls, roughly a 45% relative risk reduction, and this held up under multiplicity correction. Peripheral vascular disease was also significantly reduced, about a 25% relative risk reduction. Cardiac arrest showed a similar protective signal, roughly half the risk, but that one did not survive the Benjamini-Hochberg correction, so treated as a trend rather than a confirmed finding. Non-ST elevation MI and type 2 MI showed no difference between groups at all. And notably, this protective STEMI signal persisted specifically in patients with a prior ASCVD history, despite the fact that more than 3/4 of the whole cohort was already on a statin. The author's discussion leans into a mechanistic explanation for why this pattern makes sense, rather than looking like noise. STEMI results from plaque rupture and acute thrombotic occlusion, an atherosclerotic process niacinamide has some translational biology supporting. Whereas NSTEMI and type 2 MI are frequently secondary phenomena, supply-demand mismatch from sepsis or arrhythmia, where you wouldn't expect a plaque-stabilizing agent to move the needle. That's a reasonable argument for why splitting MACE into its component parts, rather than pooling everything into one composite endpoint the way prior studies did, uncovered a signal that a composite analysis would have washed out. They also contextualized this against the existing literature. A 2017 Cochrane review found niacin itself doesn't reduce cardiovascular risk, and after excluding biased trials, was actually linked to harm. The original OnTrack trial found no significant cardiovascular safety signal, but was underpowered for rare events with fewer than 400 patients over 18 months, and the most comparable prior retrospective study, a VA population analysis by Wellis and colleagues, found no increased MACE risk and a non-significant trend toward benefit. Broadly consistent with what's shown here, and the authors even flag likely patient overlap between the two databases, given shared institutional participation in TrinetX. Limitations are the ones you'd expect from any observational EHR study. Causality can't be established. There's the possibility of residual unmeasured confounding despite tight matching. Events occurring outside participating institutions would be missed. The population skews heavily white, which limits generalizability. And the three-year window may still be too short to capture the full cardiovascular risk-benefit picture. There's also some imprecision inherent in using ICD codes to define two-lesion NMSC history, though the authors note these codes carry high positive predictive value for pathology-confirmed skin cancer. Practically, here's how I'd frame this for your own practice. This isn't the study that proves niacinamide protects the heart. It's an observational signal, not a randomized trial, and shouldn't be oversold to patients. But it is a meaningfully reassuring answer to a concern that had started circulating in response to that niacin metabolite paper. If you've been second-guessing whether to keep recommending niacinamide chemoprophylaxis in your high-risk NMSC patients because of cardiovascular metabolite worries, this data, alongside the VA cohort finding similar reassurance, supports continuing that practice, including in patients with established atherosclerotic disease. Call this reassuring and actionable for counseling purposes, not practice changing in the sense of altering who you start on niacinamide or at what dose. Next is a JAAD game changer piece, which, as you know, is a short retrospective commentary explaining how an already published article shifted practice. The commentary authors here aren't the original investigators. This one revisits a 2024 paper by Tate and colleagues, a single-center 10-year retrospective review of Mohs micrographic surgery for melanoma in situ on the head and neck, specifically looking at what excision margins were actually required for histologic clearance and which clinical variables predicted needing wider margins. The clinical problem here needs no introduction to this audience. There's still no consensus on standardized margins for head and neck melanoma in situ, and cosmetically sensitive sites make the tension between adequate margin and tissue conservation especially sharp. The original study's findings, as distilled here, were fairly specific and site-driven. Melanoma in situ on the cheek and the eyelid, along with lesions with larger preoperative diameters, were more likely to require margins wider than 5 mm for complete clearance. Conversely, lesions on the ear tended to clear within margins narrower than 5 mm. The Game Changer authors frame the significance of this as filling a real evidence gap rather than applying a blanket 5 or 6 mm margin recommendation across the entire head and neck, the way some consensus guidelines have suggested. This data lets you calibrate your surgical planning by anatomic subsite and lesion size going into the case. There's no new methodology or limitation section to walk through here, since this is a commentary rather than original data, but the practical takeaway is worth stating plainly. If you're doing Mohs for head and neck melanoma in situ, this supports counseling patients preoperatively that cheek, eyelid, and larger lesions are more likely to need multiple stages or wider initial margins, while ear lesions may reasonably clear with tighter margins. Useful for setting expectations and possibly for initial margin planning, though it doesn't replace your own stage-by-stage histologic judgment. Third is a brief report, a research letter really, titled Medicare Data Analysis of Complex versus Intermediate Repairs Following Mohs Micrographic Surgery in Arizona, 2018 to 2021. The backdrop, the CPT coding manual redefined intermediate and complex repair codes in January 2020 after concern that complex repair codes were being overutilized nationally. A prior national analysis had already shown a 12% nationwide drop in complex repair coding among Mohs surgeons from 2019 to 2021, with the effect more pronounced in surgeons earlier in their careers and in academic practice. This group wanted to drill into a single state's data to see what's actually driving that aggregate national trend. They pulled publicly available CMS billing data for all dermatologists billing CPT 17311, the Mohs code for high-complexity anatomic sites in Arizona across those 4 years, then looked at the ratio of intermediate repair codes to complex repair codes for each of the 70 identified physicians. A descriptive claims-based approach is really the only option available here, since CMS public data doesn't let you link the Mohs code to the specific repair performed with any more granularity, and there's no chart-level clinical detail to draw on. The findings tell a story of uneven guideline adoption. Across the 70 Arizona Mohs surgeons, average intermediate repair coding increased by about 11% in the 2 years after the 2020 definition change compared to the 2 years before, consistent with the national trend. But that average masks real heterogeneity. In any given year, 30 to 40% of these surgeons coded zero intermediate repairs at all. And most strikingly, 20 of the 70, that's about 29%, never billed a single intermediate repair across all 4 years spanning the coding change, while about 10% actually decreased their intermediate coding proportion after the update, the opposite direction from what the new definitions would predict. The authors are appropriately cautious about interpretation given the descriptive-only design. They can't tell from CMS data whether a physician's practice genuinely skews toward higher complexity repairs, justifying the coding pattern, whether there's a knowledge gap about the updated definitions, financial incentive at play, or whether billing staff rather than the physician are driving these coding choices independent of clinical documentation. Their limitation section is candid about all of this. Practically, this isn't clinical practice changing in the sense of altering how you operate, but it is squarely relevant to your practice management and compliance posture. If your own coding habits haven't shifted since January 2020, if you're still defaulting heavily to complex repair codes across the board, this is a nudge to revisit the current CPT definitions with your billing staff, both to code accurately and to reduce audit risk, since persistent divergence from the post-2020 definitions is exactly the kind of outlier pattern that draws payer scrutiny. Last and worth the most time is an original multicenter study, ultraviolet-induced fluorescent dermoscopy for the diagnosis of skin tumors. Background here is a nice quick tour through dermatoscope evolution: non-polarized light requiring immersion fluid, then polarized light after 2007, revealing shiny white structures invisible under non-polarized light, and now, since 2022, ultraviolet-induced fluorescent dermoscopy, or UVFD, built into pocket dermatoscopes. UVFD had only been validated in small case series up to this point. No one had looked at its performance across a large series of actual skin tumors. That's the gap this study fills. The design is a retrospective, multi-center study across three tertiary referral clinics in Chile, Poland, and France, using consecutive biopsied lesions from a roughly 15-month window. Each lesion was imaged in polarized light, non-polarized light, and UVFD. The UVFD component using a 365-nanometer UV LED dermatoscope attachment on a smartphone, with alcohol as the immersion fluid rather than the usual gel, since alcohol doesn't interfere with the fluorescent signal. Two experienced dermoscopists, blinded to histopathology, scored each image for standard dermoscopic criteria plus two UVFD-specific features, border definition and the presence of an ochre color, with disagreements adjudicated by a third reviewer. Because invasive melanomas were underrepresented in the initial consecutive series, the authors deliberately added extra invasive melanoma cases pulled from a public cancer center to bolster that subgroup. That's a reasonable move to ensure adequate representation of a clinically important but less common outcome, but it does mean the reported prevalence of invasive melanoma in this cohort isn't a natural real-world base rate. It's enriched by design, which matters if you're trying to extrapolate diagnostic yield to your own everyday clinic mix. Of 567 lesions collected, 551 made the final analysis after excluding cases with missing data or poor image quality. Basal cell carcinoma was the single most common diagnosis at about 28%, followed by nevi at about 19%, melanoma at about 13%, of which roughly two-thirds were in situ and one-third invasive, with a mean Breslow depth around 1 millimeter, then seborrheic keratosis and squamous cell carcinoma, each around 11 to 12%. The core finding is a genuine trade-off between modalities, rather than UVFD simply outperforming polarized dermoscopy across the board. Keratin-related structures were dramatically better seen under UVFD. Keratin itself, roughly 10 times more likely to be visualized. Cometo-like openings, essentially only appreciable under UVFD in discordant cases, and fissures and ridges also favoring UVFD. Border definition was the standout finding for this audience specifically. Lesion margins were well defined in about 76% of polarized images versus 97% under UVFD, a substantial and clinically intuitive improvement given how UV fluorescence can highlight subclinical extension that visible light dermoscopy misses. On the flip side, polarized light remained superior for vessels, pigment network, milia-like cysts, blue-white veil, shiny white structures, peppering, dots, and ulceration, which makes physical sense, since several of those structures depend on polarization physics or vascular color contrast that UV fluorescence doesn't capture. Agreement between the two modalities was high, above 90% for most features, but notably lower for keratin and for border definition, which is really just another way of confirming that those are the two domains where UVFD is adding genuinely new information rather than just reproducing what polarized light already shows you. And mechanistically interesting for your invasive melanoma triage, that ochre-colored fluorescence signal was seen predominantly in invasive melanomas, rather than melanoma in situ or benign lesions, hinting at a possible non-invasive clue to invasion, though the paper's own limitation section is upfront that this was a retrospective study with several diagnostic subgroups underrepresented, so this needs prospective validation before you'd lean on it clinically. For a Mohs surgeon, I'd frame the practical takeaway in two tiers. The border definition finding is the more immediately relevant one. Better preoperative margin visualization under UVFD is directly applicable to presurgical mapping for ill-defined basal cell carcinomas or lentigo maligna, and it's plausible this could eventually inform biopsy or debulking planning, though this study didn't test whether UVFD-defined margins actually correlate with final histologic clearance or reduced stage counts. The ochre color and invasion finding is the more speculative one, intriguing as a potential adjunct clue for triaging suspicious pigmented lesions, but it's an early retrospective signal in an enriched melanoma sample, not something to act on yet. File this whole study under promising and worth watching for prospective data, particularly anything correlating UVFD-defined borders with actual surgical margin outcomes, rather than something that changes how you approach a case tomorrow. That wraps up this month's review, a reassuring cardiovascular safety signal for niacinamide chemoprophylaxis, sharper site-specific margin guidance for head and neck melanoma in situ, a reminder to audit your own repair coding against the 2020 CPT definitions, and an emerging fluorescence-based dermoscopy technique that may eventually sharpen your pre-surgical margin planning. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next month.